Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of season 11 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we create our way through the 2001 award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is Professor Sam Edwards, an associate professor at Loughborough University. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be back.
Yes. And unless you're going to be court-martialed or berated or something like that, then you don't really necessarily want to be a part of it. But
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So episode 10 begins with Sobel becoming very adamant and ends with Winters taking inventory. So we ended things yesterday with Sobel being perturbed about everything that happened beforehand. He decides to start getting a little bit of revenge on Winters because he sees Winters as a threat, even though, you know, Winters isn't the one who did anything against him, but it's just very interesting, you know, that he wants to take the brunt of it all out at on Winters. And, you know, he was complaining to Winters that he had given him an assignment and then he changed the order and Winters didn't show up 15 minutes earlier, and he basically wants to either give him some sort of punishment, or he has the opportunity to take the court-martial if he wants.
Yeah.
So again, this is a power play that Sobel's doing here to show, you know, who's the boss, who's in charge. Winters basically said yesterday that as far as he's concerned, he didn't get any message. No one came. You know, the place where he is being put up in doesn't have a phone. And then Sobel says, well, I sent a runner. And he says, well, no runner found me, Captain. And he goes, irregardless, when giving a task to perform by a ranking officer, you should have delegated your task of latrine inspection to another officer. You failed to do so. Were I to let such a failure of duty by my XO go unpunished, what kind of message is that to the men? And Winters then responds and says, but I performed my duty as I was ordered, sir. And he goes, and I disagree. So, I mean, it's an interesting debate that the two of them are having here. You know, it's the idea that, okay, you were giving an order and you never got the other order that something was changed. So what takes precedent here? You know, is it more important?
Yeah, you get this is a really interesting place in the episode in the series where you get a sense now kind of really coming through of the rivalry that's growing between Sobel and Winters. And also I think this is the point in the episode where you get a clear sense that Sobel thinks of Winter as a threat and as someone who retains and has the kind of the affection and the respect of the troops. And one of the things that comes out of that then is what we see, what you've just described there, which looks like a bit of a setup on Sobel's part, that he's gonna set Winters up for a fall, and try to use that to kind of impose his authority.
You know, even just looking at it from a military perspective, you know, if you're given an order and you don't get another order, you're supposed to still follow the first order that you got. You have to have proof that a new order is being given. I mean, I don't know. Have you ever seen the film Crimson Tide with Gene Hackman?
Yes, and
Washington? So, I mean, the basis,
film.
Exactly. I love it also. But the basis of the debate there is this exact same debate. You know, it's like, okay, if I don't get another order, it doesn't matter where I am, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. If I don't get that that order that changes the first order, I'm supposed to still continue to follow through on my first order.
Absolutely. And that's how command works in the military. Yeah.
Exactly. You're given an order, and you can't guess that someone is going to be changing your order and changing it by 15 minutes or whatever it is. I mean, again, we never find out why Sobel has decided to change this order. You know, for him saying that I tried calling and I sent a runner and whatever, you'd think that the runner would come back and say, well, I didn't find, you know, Winters. Or there's no answer on the phone. Who did you call? You know, you need to have some sort of paperwork to more or less back up, you know, the idea that you've now changed the order and that it was properly received. If it wasn't properly received, then as far as anyone's concerned, that order was not necessarily given.
Exactly. So you get a real sense here that the Winters knows this, right? So you get a sense that this is deliberately orchestrated on Sobel's part. This is an attempt to kind of do something punitive to kind of impose authority on Winters, pull him down a notch or two. But Winters, you get as well get a sense that is aware that, of what's at play here, which is why he makes the decision that he makes, which exactly. is not to to do what Sobel thinks he's going to do and do the other thing, because I think we get a sense that he knows he's on relatively sure footing, that if it goes to court-martial, that he's on solid ground.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's just it's a great debate, the way that they set this up. And yeah. I mean, I don't know if you noticed this, but when the two of them are walking towards Sobel's office, so they pass a sign that says all passes to something be shown report, what does it say, to be shown on report to desk sergeant, meaning that you know, you have to have proof that you're supposed to be here.
Yeah,
you know, which is it's great how they just have here all passes to be shown report to desk sergeant, something like that.
Yeah,
actually that doesn't even sound like proper English. Not that I'm thinking about it. All passes to be shown report to desk sergeant. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I think what they're trying to say here is that, okay, if you have a pass, make sure you show it to desk sergeant. That's it. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, nice little window there on kind of security and the importance of making sure that, you know, you could only be in the building if you were supposed to be in the building. You got to show your identity.
Hey, first of all, I love the walk and talk that they do here, that they're having this conversation in public with everyone else who's around, can hear the debate that these two men are having together. You know, they walk through, you know, someone else's office, and, you know, as they're doing this whole thing.
Yeah, it really reminds me of the walk and talks in the West Wing. Yes, yeah, so yeah, around the same kind of time. It's that that same kind of vibe that's coming given off.
Yeah, exactly. But in the West Wing, you're there with people who have you know, high enough levels of security that they can. Yeah. You know, anything you say, they can hear. That type of thing. Here, I don't know.
It's a little,
So then Sobel gets into his office, sits down, and continues talking. He says, "So your options are quite simple, Lieutenant. Punishment for your offenses will be denial of a 48 pass for 60 days. And then he looks over at Winters and goes, "Stand before me at attention." Which, again, it's strange that he's getting very formal at this point. Because I think he's starting to get the vibe from Winters that this isn't necessarily going to go the way I want it to, but maybe not. You know, he's not 100% sure. And then he says, "Or you may initiate a letter of appeal and request a trial by court martial." And then, you know, he looks over at Winters, who doesn't respond, and he says, "You spend your weekends on the base anyway, Dick. Be a man. Take the punishment." And I think this sets off Winters even more, because that's not a way to encourage somebody. It's not saying, "Okay, you know what? You're already going to be there. Just take the punishment, move on, and that's it." And Winters isn't going to have it. Now, what I find really funny about this line is that we had, I believe it must have been earlier this week, maybe it was the end of last week, that Sobel wanted Winters to give punishment to some of the men, and what he ended up doing was giving punishment to the men whose turn it was to clean the latrine. So it's sort of the same type of thing here. You know, like, Sobel wants to give Winters a punishment, but the punishment is not really it's more for everyone to be able to see that he's given him a punishment, but not necessarily to punish Winters, because Winters himself, it's not going to affect what the way that he conducts himself, because he's still there anyway.
Yeah, it's like an assertion of his power. It's all about the optics. It's all about showing that he can do this, that he can impose a punishment if he so chooses. And how you described the encounter there, I think is really interesting as well. That you get a sense that when Sobel says to Dick Winters, you know, "Take the punishment, be a man. You're on base anyway." That's the mistake, right? Because that's where he reveals his hand. He reveals his hand. He reveals what's at stake here to Winters, which is he just wants to impose a punitive punishment on him. And in that moment, you get there's a sort of nice lingering shot of Winters' face, and you get a sense, oh no, he's seen the hand played, and he's now gonna trump it.
That's right. And then it's actually quite funny. And then he says, "Can I borrow your pen?" And he gives him the pen, and then he takes the paper or the report and endorses it. And he gives it back to him and goes, "My endorsement, sir. I request trial by court martial." And Sobel is in complete shock.
Yeah, just total look of panic on his face. Yeah.
Yes, because he didn't expect it to go this way.
Yeah.
I started reading it yesterday, but I'll continue reading it now. Just talk about it. So he basically said, punishment under 104th Articles of War, First Lieutenant R.D. Winters, you will indicate by endorsement, and remember I said yesterday that endorsement was misspelled with an I, below whether you desire punishment under 104th Articles of War or trial by courts, martial, for failure to inspect the latrine at 9:45 this date as instructed by me. And this is the 30th of October, 1943. And this is signed with grand flourish, Herbert M. Sobel, Captain Commanding. Winters confronted Sobel. "Captain," he said, after saluting and asking permission to speak, "my orders were to inspect the latrine at 1000 hours. I changed that time to 9:45. No one told me. I telephoned and I sent a runner." Winters bit his tongue. There was no telephone in his room and no runner had come. It was time for inspection. Strayer went down the ranks and through the barracks. Everything, including the latrine, was satisfactory. Winters, meanwhile, made up his mind on how to respond to Sobel. On the bottom of the type sheet, he wrote by hand, "Subject, punishment under 104th Articles of War or trial by courts-martial, to Captain H.M. Sobel. I request trial by courts-martial for failure to inspect the latrine at 9:45 this date." And then he signed it to his name. And then it says, Sobel replied the following day, you'll be denied a 48-hour pass until after December 15th, 1943. In accordance with the procedure outlined in the courts-martial manual, you will initiate," and it spells initiate incorrectly also, and then it has the correct spelling of initiate in parentheses, and it says, "Sergeant Evans evidently had trouble either typing or spelling, and so you will initiate your own letter of appeal with the reasons for objection and also a request for trial by courts-martial." Winter simmered for 3 days. So far, he could make out Sobel was saying, "Look, don't be silly. Take the punishment and forget the courts martial." Sobel knew that the punishment was a matter of indifference to Winters, as Winters spent his weekends on the post, reading or playing sports. But Winters had had enough. He wanted to force the moment to a crisis. The competition he had never wanted between himself and Sobel for leadership of E Company had to be settled. The company was not big enough for both of them. On November 4th, Winters appealed his punishment under the 104th Articles of War. Sobel made an endorsement, again with an I, says Evans' spelling, the next day. Punishment for the above offense given by the undersigned will not be lifted by him. When given another task performed by ranking officer to myself, Strayer's order to censor the mail, you should have delegated your task to another officer to inspect the latrine and not let it go until such time that there was little time for corrective measures to be taken before the arrival of the general officer about 10 minutes later. He signed with his usual flourish. Winter's request for course martial, meanwhile, was posing a problem that was not as funny as it sounded for the 2nd Battalion staff. The officers got out the court martial manual and studied intensively to try and figure out some way to get out from under this embarrassment. They finally did, and Strayer set aside the punishment and declared the case closed. No court martial.
Yeah.
So, again, the whole thing is just is crazy.
It is crazy. And as you say, brings it out to a point of crisis, because Winters knows that if this is, as you said, it doesn't go to court martial, but if it does go to court martial, this is going to be an embarrassment. It's going to drain resources at a time when there are more important things to be done than organize a court martial for something as small scale as what Sobel is trying to pin on Winters here. And it's really interesting as well, because I mean, maybe this is something that your listeners could follow up on, but I think the document itself might even still be out there. I think there were maybe some works published maybe 10, 15 years or so ago now. I think one may be revisiting some of the history of Band of Brothers and Dick Winters. And I think there might be an image of that original document with Dick Winters signing. Don't know for definite, but I've got a sense somewhere that might be the case, or maybe something that that your listeners could look into.
Right. I assume that there probably is the letter out there, because of the fact that, you know, for Winters to have to remember exactly what was misspelled 40 or 50 years later is amazing in and of itself. You know, so he probably had a copy of the letters. But what I find really fascinating is that, you know, what the writers did here You know, they you know, in the book they talk about the fact that this was basically letters. You know, for anyone listening today, it would be just sending emails. You know,
yes,
but yeah. These were letters that you know that you usually got the same day. I mean, it's not something that you know, they weren't that far apart where it really would have made a difference. But the idea was that they were sending these letters back and forth between each other, and the writers decided, hey, wait a second, why do we need to do that? Let's just have the two of them have this as a conversation. And I think it's much more effective as a conversation because you get to also see the facial expressions and the emotions that are involved in this, as opposed to just someone writing and saying, oh, I'm pissed, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And it's also, I think it needs to be in person because this is a confrontation ultimately between these two individuals over, you know, over leadership of Easy Company. And I think for the episode to work and for us to understand that relationship between these two characters, we need that confrontation to happen in front of our eyes in the way that it does. Even if in doing so, you do lose a little bit of that kind of World War II era authenticity. You just described there the letters going back and forth on the same day. And it reminds us that the World War II United States military is a military machine, and it's also a clerical machine as well. Like vast quantities of paperwork generated on an hourly, daily basis in order to organize and to administer this behemoth, this enormous military organization.
That's right. And again, it all goes down to the bottom line. You know, you need to have paperwork on everything. It's in order to cover your ass. That's what the CYA.
Absolutely.
That's all it is. You know,
and for me as a historian, it's the kind of the bread and butter of what I do. I need that kind of material. And you mentioned when you were talking there about how, you know, in the modern era, this kind of back and forth of paperwork would all be electronic, of course, now, and absolutely it would be. And as me as a historian, I'm kind of left thinking, well, in 100 years' time, what are the historians of 100 years' time? Can they get hold of that stuff? Can they recover that material? Can they give us that same sense of the minutiae, the detail of how you know, in this instance, the US military was kind of working, how it operated, if we don't have that kind of paper trail, I guess. And you know, I won't be around in 100 years to see, but it'll be interesting.
No, but you have the electronic paper trails of it all. That's the thing. But the problem with an electronic paper trail is it's easy to be manipulated or changed if you need to.
Exactly. Or disappear into the ether or not be stored and that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Correct. But it is easier to store. that's the, you know, there's the pluses and minuses to everything. You know, it's
it doesn't take up the same kind of it doesn't require the same kind of mileage of shelving to store. Absolutely.
That's correct. That's correct. And so, I mean, this is just great the way that they have this little conversation between these two men. Winters knows what he's asking for.
Yes.
You know, he knows that this is all a joke and that when people will see what Sobel is doing, they might look at this and say, wait, wait a second, what's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. If he pushes for the course martial and it gets to Colonel Sink, that it's gonna come down to Sobel.
Exactly. And again, when you look at it and you say, okay, you're putting someone on court martial for not being somewhere for 15 minutes when they have a perfectly good excuse as to why they weren't there, because they didn't get this changed order because they were in the process of following a higher officer's order, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. 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 I guess I find it really interesting as well, because again, it gives you a little window on how militaries work. You know, in the British military, they talk about the bullshit that goes with being in the military, the stuff that you just have to do. And I think in the US military, the kind of equivalent would be kind of talking about the chicken that you have to do. Exactly. You just get a little bit of a sense of that coming through here.
Right, exactly. 100%. And especially back during World War II. I mean, that's, I mean, the fact that even in the book, they talk about the fact that everyone in battalion started reading, you know, all of the instruction manuals and the court martial because they're not used to this type of thing. Like, what do we do in this situation? Someone, you know, it's one thing to court martial somebody for something that is needed, but on the other hand, you know, you're court martialing somebody for something so silly. I mean, again, yes. I'm not saying that following an order is silly. Obviously, if you are given an order, you know, to inspect something 15 minutes earlier, it makes sense. I'm not belittling that at all, but in this particular situation, where is Sobel's proof that Winters got the information that it was changed 15 minutes earlier? You know, because again,
exactly, and that's
saying I sent a runner and someone called. Okay, so you know, a proper detective will be able to say, okay, fine, give me a copy of the letter, and I want the sworn testimony of the runner that they got there. I mean, again, the runner here probably would be Evans, who easily would have lied, you know, to please Sobel. But again, you know, the idea is that you know, it would come down to my word against your word. You know, that's evident.
Yeah. Which is exactly then what Sobel doesn't want it to come down to.
No, of course not. Because then
it exposes everything. Yeah.
Sobel's entire goal here was just to say, okay, I've now punished my XO. Everyone, look, you know, I'm a badass. Yeah. You know, I'm a disciplinarian. And, you know, Winters didn't do what I told him to do. It doesn't matter what he didn't do. He didn't do it. He's going to be punished. That's more or less what he's trying to get at here. And Winters,
that's exactly it. No one is above my authority in this company. Even officers will be subject to me.
That's right. And Winters doesn't want to be any part of this. You know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like the way that they present it. And then he salutes Sobel and then just walks out of the room.
Yeah.
Sobel is still very, very shocked. And then we get a shot outside. The NCOs are all talking. You have Harris come into the room and he goes, we lost Winters to battalion mess. He goes, you're shitting me. He goes, no. Sure you did it while they try to figure out the procedures for his court-martial. And someone says, Nixon better find a loophole to get him out. And if he don't, Winters scrambles eggs for the rest of, with the rest of us, make the big jump with Sobel. Not me. So they all sit down, you know, around the table, and they're discussing their different options. And then one of them goes, so we're going through with this, right? We got to do something. Yeah. All right. Good. And Lipton says, but we'd all better be clear of the consequences. And then one of them says, I don't care about the consequences. Yeah. He says, we could be lined up against a wall and shot. Now I'm ready to face that. And every one of us had better be too. And then Garnier says, I will not follow that man into combat. And Bull goes, me neither. And Lipton goes, all right. And they goes, then let's do it. And they all start, you know, writing on pieces of paper. And we hear Garnier saying what he's writing. He goes, I hereby no longer wish to serve as a non-commissioned officer in Easy Company. And then Lipton goes, all right, boys, good luck. So, again, this is an interesting way for this story to move along. I mean, again, we're well aware of the fact that this is really what happened. You know, it isn't something that was just made up. And, you know, some of these men, we know who they are, you know, from the show, from interviews. And, you know, they really were concerned about going into battle with Sobel after everything that they've shown us. Yeah. I mean, again, we've only had, what is it, about 45 minutes of this first episode, this first part. But on the other hand, you know, we can see that Sobel leading them into combat is not necessarily a very good idea.
Yeah.
And they,
yeah.
They don't want to risk their lives or the lives of the men under them for that very fact.
Yes. Yeah.
Cause it goes along with what Winters was just doing right now. The whole idea of you're in the army, you have to follow orders. It doesn't matter how stupid the order is. You have to follow the order.
Yeah. And yet what we see the sergeants doing here, where they have their meeting, they organize, they make a kind of collective decision about how they're going to respond. And they all, you know, they all write their bit of paper and sign their name, saying what they're not prepared to do going forward. What you get a sense of there is one of the key features, I guess, of the World War II United States military, that it is, historians and scholars talk about it as not just that the vast expansion of the US military militarized society, but also that the vast expansion of the US military drawing in civilians civilianized the military. And what you get a sense of is a little bit of that here. You've got a group of sergeants, and yes, they're subject to military authority and they know their duty and they don't intend to kind of contravene their ethos of military duty. But at the same time, they have a real frustration here. They have a real concern about what might happen. And so they do something which in other militaries of this same era would be unthinkable. That is, they get together, they sit down, they make a decision, and then they send it off to Colonel Sink. And they know that, you know, the consequences might be pretty dire, but they also do so in the knowledge that it's not going to be you know, it probably won't be backs against the wall and shot. There'll be consequences, but it won't be quite that. Just, yeah, you get a sense of how kind of power and authority has to operate in the World War II military because of the millions of formerly civilians that have been conscripted into it and their expectations and what they are not prepared to do in certain circumstances.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's so easy to see that and I mean, I like what you said about the fact that because these men come from civilian life and you know they're not career army men, you know, they're more or less draftees. They're draftees or volunteers, you know, because of patriotism or whatever. But you know, they're not people who normally would fit into the structure of a military aspect. So therefore, you know, they do know how to think on their own, that type of thing.
Yeah. And the military wants that from them. You know, one of the reasons why the US military in World War II and afterwards is so successful is because it doesn't reduce the soldier to a kind of an unthinking automaton. You know, it wants independent thinkers. It wants them, especially as sergeants, they're supposed to be capable, independent leaders, you know, able to kind of respond to whatever happens in combat, to exercise their initiative. But one consequence of that is that if that's what you're cultivating in your military culture, is what we see in this scene here, that in this instance, where they're seriously concerned about the qualities and caliber of their immediate superior, Sobel, that they act accordingly. But that's the payoff, right? You want capable, independent, initiative using you know, squad leaders. Well, one payoff might be that in this particular context situation, they might do something like this.
Right, exactly. The truth is, no one really expected this to happen, but you know, it did. You know, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And then the scene changes, and we see Colonel Sink, and he says, "I ought to have you all shot. This is nothing less than an act of mutiny while we prepare for the goddamn invasion of Europe." And, you know, Sink doesn't want to play around here. He just goes, "Sergeant Harris, sir, turn in your stripes. Collect your gear. You are hereby transferred out of my regiment. Sir, get out." So it's very funny that it's transferred out of my regiment. So, you know, he's not saying where he's going to go. He's just saying, okay, you're no longer a sergeant and you're going elsewhere. You know, that's it.
Yeah.
And then he goes, "Sergeant Rainey," he goes, "sir, you consider yourself lucky. I'm only busing you to a private." And again, okay, it's a punishment, but it's not really a punishment from that perspective. I mean, it's a punishment probably from a pay perspective and from, you know, what the authority you have within the unit, but you're still in the unit. You know, that's the whole thing. And then he says, "All of you NCOs have disgraced the 101st Airborne. You can consider yourself lucky that we are on the eve of the largest action in the history of warfare, which leaves me no choice but to spare your life. Now get out of my office and get out of my sight." And he goes, "Get." And then everyone, you know, just basically leaves his office. But again, Sink knows that there's a big problem here and that he needs to deal with it. And, you know, by shooting these men, that's not what's going to do it. You know, so let's just, you know, we give out two punishments and that's it. You know, I guess Harris was the top sergeant that was there. And therefore, that's why he's getting his punishment. And Rainey was the one right under him. So, okay. Again, that's these are fair punishments to want to give them from the whole thing.
So make an example of the ringleaders and then, yeah.
Yeah. The book talks about that the men actually went and discussed it with Winters before they went, and Winters told them don't do it, it's mutiny.
Yeah.
But they didn't care. They said we have no inclination of going out there and being led by Sobel. And they even tried getting Evans to join in with them and didn't show up. And he had told Sobel that there was going to be a meeting with the men here.
Yeah, it's a really powerful scene in the office because. What we're starting to see there is a sense that maybe Colonel Sink himself is aware of the limitations of Sobel, but at the same time, you know, respect for rank, military authority, he can't be seen to in any way condone what the sergeants have done because that's potentially toxic to the kind of good order, the command and control in his regiment. So there needs to be a punishment. There needs to be a consequence But at the same time, he needs to weigh that against the broader needs of company, of regiment in the upcoming, you know, largest endeavor in the history of warfare. And what we see then is the, yeah, the ringleaders are as identified, as suggested by the punishment, are punished, and the others are you know, kicked out of the office. Yeah,
right. I mean, and again, it you know, they all lucked out from that perspective.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the same idea. Whenever you're dealing with a situation where people are of different status or stature, you know, and even in the family structure, you know, the idea that you know, parents need to be on the same page about things and not belittle the other parent in front of the children and something like that, you know.
Yeah.
And not say, oh, why did you give them that punishment, or you should do that. There's certain things that you need to have on your, you do in a different setting. So it's the same idea here with Think.
Yes.
Think realizes that he has a problem with Sobel, but he knows that he's not going to open up that problem with the men.
Yes.
You know, so yeah. Therefore, as you said, he needs to show a combined front with Sobel right now, and then deal with Sobel on the side.
Yes, and I guess one way he can do that in his mind potentially is to put to one side the identity of the captain, right? And so to put to one side for a moment that it's Sobel, and just focus on, for the purposes of what he's going to do, this is you know, mutinous activity, as he refers to it, against a captain, and that is, from Singh's perspective, you know, one of his immediate subordinates. So this is a mutinous endeavor against a captain, and that's what he's punishing there, pushing to side Sobel's identity for one moment. Although we know, and as this episode progresses, we learn even more that Singh does seem to have some concerns over his leadership.
Right. On Monday we'll talk more about that, about how that all plays out. But yeah. It's you know, it makes sense that it would be done in this type of situation.
It does.
The book doesn't really explain why Harris and Rainey were singled out, though. It just mentions that Rainey was busted to a private and Harris was removed, and that's it. So, you know, it's unfortunate that it doesn't give us a little more. It just says Harris was transferred. It doesn't even say to where or anything like that. You know?
Yeah, okay.
Which makes me wonder, you know, again, I don't know what eventually happened to Harris. I don't know if he made it through World War II or not. But you'd think that you know, did he regret this later in life because he wasn't part of Easy Company? Or did he find something else? I mean, again, we don't know the answer to this because I didn't do research on what eventually happened to Harris. But it's an interesting question.
I might have picked up somewhere, but I'd need to check this. And again, maybe some of your listeners to check up on. I'm not sure if maybe did Harris get drawn back into Easy Company at a later point in maybe in Normandy. I might have picked that up somewhere. I don't know for definite, though. So maybe it's something for listeners to pursue.
I don't see that he was. Right, his name is Salty Harris. It says that Rainey and Harris were the ones in charge of this meeting. So that's sort of, I guess, the reason that the two of them were singled out here. They were more or less the ringleaders, as you stated. But Harris is not mentioned in the book after that. Okay. So, again, maybe he did come back. Because, again, you know, the book, as great as it is, and as great as the miniseries is, neither of them is an ironclad proof of truth of anything.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, the book is basically based on 40-year-old memories of men. You know, I'm sure they had diaries, they had notes and stuff like that. But a lot of the information can be disputed. Let's put it that way. But again, I'm not belittling it at all, because I think it's great storytelling, and hopefully it's as close to the truth as possible, you know, from that perspective. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of the men, there were certain things that they just didn't discuss, you know, whether it was stuff against other men, or whether it was, you know, other men in the unit, or things that they might have did that they could get in trouble for, or something like that. So they're you know, even 40 years later, they're not going to tell those stories, you know, that type of
thing. Yeah.
So again, I don't know if Harris rejoined them at any point. If you know what, maybe I'll try and get in touch with George Luz Jr. and ask him if he knows the answer to that. That would be interesting to know.
That's, That's cool, because I've got in my head somewhere that maybe he does rejoin Easy Company in when he gets to Normandy. I'm not sure he survives the battle of the campaign in Normandy, Battle of Normandy. But again, this is stuff that I'm remembering here on,
Okay.
as we
Again,
talk. So yeah.
I will write to him, and we have the entire weekend, till Monday when you come back, and hopefully by then I'll have an answer from George Laws Jr. as to
There we
about
go.
Harris. I mean, that works well. It's good
Perfect.
to have an open encyclopedia that I can contact directly.
There you
Get a point there.
go.
Then the shot changes, and we're now outside, and we see men unloading big pots and pans from a truck, and we see Winters on the side taking inventory about the food. I mean, again, we know he's now the new mess officer, and then he sees all of the NCOs come out of Sink's office, the building, and he just looks at them, and they all just give him they all just salute him. He salutes him back. I mean, again, he knows where they just were and isn't sure about what has happened here. What the actual punishment is or anything like that. But then he looks back at them, and he we can sort of see a smirk come across his face, meaning that okay, I'm aware of the fact that what these men are doing is good. So I like that. I like that. Just that little smirk just works very, very well.
I absolutely agree, and I think the whole scene is quite powerful as well, quite poignant, quite powerful, because it suggests that the exact opposite of what Sobel's trying to achieve in the kind of orchestrated punitive punishment of Winters has actually unfolded. That he's trying to do so, as we've discussed, to demonstrate really publicly his kind of authority and power over the company, and especially over Winters. But then what comes through in this scene, where the sergeants, marching formation past Winters, each saluting as they do so, is quite how far the men's affection and respect still absolutely remains with Winters.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So, Sam, do you have anything else you want to say about this particular 5-minute segment?
No, I think we've covered all the bases there, Rob. That was really good.
All right. Excellent. So, today we will play the World War II movie trivia game. And
Go
I
for it.
will randomly ask you 5 questions about the movies that are related to World War II. And
Okay.
we'll see how good your memory is.
Let's see. Yeah.
Hopefully it's good. Hopefully it's good. So let's spin the wheel and see what questions we get. And around and around and around the wheel goes. Okay. Who plays the main character in the 1989 movie Fat Man and Little Boy?
Oh man, the main character, Fat Man and Little Boy. No, I can picture the film. No, I can't remember.
Okay. I mean, you remember what that movie's about, right?
It's about the bombs, isn't it?
Yes. So the main character
Yeah.
is the character is General Leslie Groves, played by Paul Newman.
Okay, Paul Newman, of course. Yeah. God, I haven't watched that film in years.
Yeah, me too. It's been a while since I've seen it, especially now that Oppenheimer came out. Less, I guess, less relevant.
Yeah.
All right, so let's spin the wheel and see what the next question will be. Okay. In the 1967 film The Dirty Dozen, a squad of condemned soldiers are sent on a daring mission to attack a chateau. Who plays the commander?
It's Lee Marvin, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
But hey.
You see, it's all random. You get 2 questions about the lead characters.
Hey.
Okay. There is a movie from 1979 starring Richard Gere
Yep.
playing an American soldier in England at around
Oh,
the same time, I guess. So,
this one's perfect for me, Rob. This one's perfect. I've literally written stuff about this. So this is Yanks, 1979, Richard Gere.
excellent. Excellent. You see? There you go. I gotta say, I didn't like the movie very much. It wasn't terrible, but I didn't find it to be that great. I'm now curious to know what you wrote about it.
So I wrote a kind of an article a few years ago, an academic article, but it was looking at all the various film and TV shows that have told the story of the World War II friendly invasion of Britain by American GIs. So I talked about Yanks amongst others. And yeah, it's not a great film, but I think of all those in that context of all the various film and TV that have kind of told that story of Yanks meeting Brits in the 1940s in England. I think of all those kind of stories, I think it's one of the better ones. Not perfect, but one of the better in that context.
Okay. Fair enough. All right, that's great. See, that worked out perfect for you.
That's it.
All right, place in the wheel for your fourth question. Okay, who wrote the miniseries from 1983, Winds of War?
Oh yeah, I've got the book of this. It's gonna bug me. No, it's gone. Go on, tell me.
Okay, it starred Robert Mitchum, Ally McGraw, Jan Michael Vincent.
Yep.
It's the same author for War and Remembrance.
War Remembrance, I've got that one as well. Yeah, and I part of me wants to turn around and look at my shelves, but I won't cheat. Okay. So no, go and tell me.
Okay, I'll give you some initials. Maybe that'll help. H.W.
Wook.
Herman Wook. Exactly. Very good.
Wook. That's it. Yay. Got that.
Okay. Yeah. When you said you have it on yeah on the shelf behind you, I was like, all right, don't cheat. So thank you for. For showing your integrity there.
I try.
Much appreciated. All right, and now we will spin the wheel and give you your final question. And around and around and around the wheel goes. Okay, the 2014 movie The Imitation Game tells the story of which British mathematician who helped crack the Enigma code?
It's Alan Turing.
Very good.
How many did I get, Rob? Was that 4 out of 5?
You got 4 out of 5, yeah. You just missed Fat Man and Little Boy. That was it. So that nicely done. That's nicely it. Done.
Okay.
You can keep your professorship.
I would be giving up if I'd got less than 3. I think I'd just have to give it up. Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm saying you can keep it. There you go. 80%. 80% is passing, isn't it?
I'll take it. I'll take it.
Okay. All right. And now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie. So let's see what you're going to get. Round and around the wheel goes. Okay, this is a movie from 1951, starring John Wayne.
Okay.
This is a movie from 1951 starring John Wayne and Robert Ryan about a group of pilots in the Wildcats squadron during the Battle of Guadalcanal.
Is it the Flying Tigers?
Very close. Very close. You got the flying right.
Flying.
Think of.
Joe, I think the DVD is probably.
Stop cheating. Think of. think of another name for the Marines, for a Marine. So it's not the Flying Tiger.
Bootnecks.
No, you're close. You got the next part right.
Leathernecks.
That's right. Flying Leathernecks. There you go. Excellent. Nicely done. Nicely done, Sam.
Well, I needed a bit of help there, Rob, so I appreciate that.
No, Rob. No, you got the flying part, so I knew you were going in the right direction. So that makes a lot of sense. All right. Would you like to tell everyone where they can find Sam Edwards?
So you can find me via my webpage, which is therunninghistorian.co.uk, and you can also find me on Substack as The Running Historian. You can find me on LinkedIn as Sam Edwards, and you can find me if you just chuck Sam Edwards Loughborough University into Google.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Run Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierunminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierunminute@movierun.net. So everyone have a great weekend. Sam and I will be back on Monday. But until then, Curry!
Curry!